Hi everyone. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for having invited me to give this talk today, which I have entitled Auditory Cortical Tracking of Self-Produced Speech and Visual Speech. So, the talk will be mainly about the cortical tracking of speech and how I have used it with collaborators to better understand how the brain monitors the speech that we produce to correct errors, and how the brain leverages visual speech information to enhance speech comprehension and speech processing. But first of all, let's define what is cortical tracking of speech. So it is the phenomenon by which auditory cortical oscillations, as can be measured by EEG or MEG, track or entrain or phase lock with the temporal envelope of speech when we listen to speech. So the cortical tracking of speech occurs mainly at two different time scales, at a time scale matching with the repetition rate of syllables, that is in between 4 and 8 hertz, and at a time scale matching with the repetition rate of phrases and sentences, that is below 1 hertz. Some studies have also reported significant tracking in between at a time scale corresponding to words, so in between 2 and 4 hertz. Phrasal tracking is represented in the brain in regions beyond early auditory cortices, that is in the posterior superior temporal sulcus, while the tracking of the syllables occurs mainly in supratemporal auditory cortices. In terms of the most up-to-date model of Hickok and Popple, that would make syllable tracking correspond to processing of the temporal and spectral properties of speech sounds, while phrasal tracking would relate to hierarchically higher processes such as phonological processing or mapping sound onto meaning. So let's move to the first study I want to present you today, which is in which we have used the framework of cortical tracking of speech, that is presenting continuous speech to participants, but this time to propose to probe speech production. So the setup is fairly easy, and anyone could have thought of that. We just place participants in the MEG and or EEG and record their brain activity while they speak. So the first question to ask are why would that be relevant and why is it challenging? So it is relevant because the architecture, neuronal architecture, the basis of speech production and monitoring of the auditory feedback is actually quite complex. So initially, it was assumed that speech production errors in speech production are mainly analyzed thanks to an external feedback system. So that when we speak, the speech signal is analyzed by the auditory cortices and further brain areas, and that can be helped to detect errors and correct our errors in later utterances. But such external feedback monitoring system is that doesn't account for empirical evidence that some errors are corrected online at a really fast pace. So to account for the fast corrections, most up-to-date models include an internal monitoring system. And this internal monitoring system is fed by the articulatory comments sent by the motor cortices to the articulators. And based on that reference comment, the internal monitoring system can already predict errors really early in time. What we postulated in the study I will present is that a hallmark of internal monitoring system would be enhanced coupling from the brain to the speech in the context of speech production. And finding such hallmark would give empirical evidence for the existence of an internal speech monitoring implemented in the brain. And the question of why is it challenging? So that can be seen already in these two excerpts of some of MEG signals. So here in quiet condition, and here why the participant was speaking. It is easy to see that when the participant was speaking, some artifacts were present, because when we speak, we make mouth movements, jaw movements, and our muscles also receive some electrical activity that generate muscle artifacts. In this talk, we will be mainly concerned with movement artifacts, because we are looking at brain activity at frequencies below 10 Hz, and muscle artifacts do not have any frequency content below that frequency of 10 Hz. So in the study, we included 17 participants and asked them to listen to connected speech in one condition, to read the text aloud in another condition, and to listen to their to themselves in a third condition. So to the recording we made of them while they read the text aloud in the read condition. Recorded brain activity with MEG and used several techniques to reduce artifacts. The first was temporal signal space separation and then independent component analysis. We estimated the coupling with coherence and renormalized partial directed coherence to get at the directionality of the coupling between brain and speech. And finally, reconstructed brain sources with dynamic imaging of coherent sources, which, owing to the nature of this source reconstruction method, we also expect to have a reduction in the artifacts. Here you can see the effect of pre-processing on brain signals average across all gradiometers and participants. You can see in black the trace corresponding to the read condition, and in gray the trace corresponding to the listen condition. So power was about twice higher in the read than in the listen condition, meaning that artifacts were about as high as gene brain signals. But after temporal signal space separation and independent component analysis, the discrepancy was brought to less than 25% higher in the read than in the listening condition, which gave us hope that we could actually analyze true genuine brain signals. So we tried to make sure that we did not remove all the genuine brain signals by looking at coherence topography with speech in all the conditions. In the listen and playback conditions, we found canonical topographies, that is, in perisylvian areas bilaterally, and also peaks at phrasal rate, and also to some extent at syllable rate. In the reading condition, the pattern was a bit more confused. Not so much at phrasal rate, where we could already distinguish quite easily significant coupling peaking at sensors above auditory cortices. But the pattern was a bit less clear at word and syllable frequencies. However, after partialing out the activity coming from sensors on the edge of the sensor array, which are here depicted with pink dots, we could easily see a clear pattern of both bilateral auditory cortices in all frequency ranges in this reading condition. Following that, we move to the source space. And again, the results were quite encouraging. Generally speaking, in all conditions and frequency ranges, we saw cortical tracking of speech in perisylvian areas. There were some artifacts in the reading condition, of course, close to the temporal pole and frontal pole, and also close to the pons. But these artifacts were of amplitude even weaker than the genuine brain signal in auditory regions. As a conclusion of that, temporal signal space separation in combination with independent component analysis and beamformer was effective at taming artifacts, so that there was hope to retrieve interesting neurophysical findings. At Fraser rate, in all conditions, we found the involvement of the supratemporal auditory cortex, denoted here as STAC, and also of the PSTS in the listening conditions. At the two higher frequencies, that is corresponding to words and syllables, the coherent speak more dorsal in the read condition compared to the listening conditions. So it was in the parietal operculum, which is close to sensory motor brain areas responsible for articulatory mouth movements. Last point worth noticing is that the topography and the magnitude of the coherence was relatively similar in the two listening conditions, that is in listen and playback. Comparing the coherence level revealed that the coherence was always similar in the listen and playback condition. That phrasal rate, it was higher in the listening conditions than in the reading condition, while the opposite was seen at word and syllabic frequencies. So higher tracking in the read condition compared to the listening condition. Some postdoc analysis revealed that the first effect could have been driven by artifacts, because after partialing out artifacts on the edge sensors, this effect disappeared. But it did not disappear at syllabic and word rates. And finally, as a last result, so you can see here the result for the directionality analysis. Generally speaking, the coupling was always stronger from the speech to the brain than from the brain to speech, which is expected, as when we hear sound, what is most salient is processing in auditory cortices of what we hear or what we've been saying. Fraser rate, the speech to brain coupling was actually decreased, which parallels the controversial effect we found with coherence. And the most interesting result was occurred at 4 to 8 Hz at syllabic rate, and that was an increase in the brain to speech coupling in the reading condition compared to the listening conditions, which is, according to our working hypothesis, a hallmark of the existence of an internal speech monitoring system. So our study demonstrated that the human brain tracks the speech temporal envelope at frequencies of phrases, words, and syllables during both listening and reading conditions. In the context of the reading condition, the brain area involved was more dorsal, suggesting also the involvement of sensory motor brain regions. This finding nicely extends that of Ruspantinian collaborators, who used a bit less naturalistic stimuli and also identified the involvement of these very same brain regions. In their experiments, they used a repetition of a single syllable, the syllable pa. So we have demonstrated that in all conditions, the cortical tracking of speech is dominated by auditory feedback processing during both reading aloud and listening. The most interesting result was an enhancement of internal speech monitoring outside of a rate in the listening in the reading condition compared to the listening condition. So this gives support to the existence of internal speech monitoring system, and it also tells that such monitoring system could operate at syllable rate. And if we remember what tracking of syllable means or is associated to, so this could also correspond to an analysis of low-level sound features such as temporal and spectral processing. The last result that was a bit more contentious was decreased coupling in the read compared to the listen condition at phrasal rate. So this effect would nicely parallel the finding of attenuation of the N100 component to self-produced speech, but it would wait further confirmation by other studies, as the result was did not survive some of our controls in which we included partial coherence, where we removed activity from sensors on the edge of the sensor array. There are some methodological considerations that need to be made at this stage. So first, we noticed that the tracking was similar on the listen and playback condition. And because these conditions differed much in the same way as listen and reading condition differed, we can infer that the CTS was not influenced, or our general effects were not influenced by priming about upcoming speech and potential differences in speech rhythmicity. So the effect we found in comparison between reading and listening were not a consequence of the fact that subjects could read slower or faster than what they had to hear, which was anyway not the case. A second consideration is that artifacts at frequencies below 8 Hz were satisfactorily dealt with linear projection or regression techniques, but some more advanced method could be used, and for that I would refer to the paper by the group of Joachim Gross published in Frontiers very recently. And of course, all these were results obtained with MEG and some data pre-processing and so on. So it would definitely be very great to have confirmation of the finding of this study and of further findings using invasive recordings. So this concludes the first study I wanted to present you, and I will now move to the second study, in which we investigated tracking of silent visual speech. So visual speech is an important signal, as it provides some redundant and also complementary information to the auditory signal of speech, and it is especially important and critical when there is noise. I guess you have all noticed that it is harder now to understand people as they are wearing face masks. And this is not only a consequence of sound attenuation, it is also because we are sorely lacking this visual information that helps us understand speech in normal daily life as we used to know it. Okay, but the question we wanted to ask in this study is how the brain extracts meaning from visual speech. To that question, there have been several answers or hypotheses in the past. So initially, it was thought that the speech would be recorded into like visual speech, lip movements, by that I mean, would be recorded into acoustic information. So the brain would see lip movements and kind of transduce them into sounds so that it can later on use auditory regions to make sense of that sound. But it was, and that idea was based on the finding that when seeing silent lip movements of people articulating single vowels or syllables, It was found that auditory cortices do activate in fMRI studies. But this view was criticized, and it was said that maybe this could simply relate to auditory imagery, and such recording is very unlikely to happen because it is computationally demanding. So as an alternative hypothesis, it was hypothesized that the brain would would directly derive meaning from the visual speech through the visual pathway. And there would be actually two main pathway to understand visual speech. One would be the ventral pathway here in red that would extract lip configuration to directly derive phonemic identity. And the second pathway, the dorsal pathway in blue here, would be more tuned at the temporal properties of the visual speech to define excitability periods to help the auditory cortex process incoming auditory speech. So what was missing to prove the existence of speech recording was temporal resolution to exclude the hypothesis of speech imagery. So that's why we used speech tracking, the framework of speech tracking, to get at this question. In the study I will now present, we included 28 participants and had them attend videos of somebody speaking, but the sound was not present. So it was silent visual speech. In another condition, they heard the sound only of another recording. And in a third condition, they heard, they just saw the movement of the mouth, but that were transduced onto a cross. So the color of the cross was changing as function of mouth opening, mouth width, and mouth surface. In that context, we used coherence analysis to estimate the coupling between brain activity and speech signal, auditory speech, and visual speech signals. The main finding of the study was that at frazzle rate, there was a significant coupling with the sound, with speech temporal envelope, in the video-only condition, and that the topography was very similar in the audio-only and video-only condition. So in the video-only condition, just to say it in another way, this means that the brain tracked the sound that was not present just based on a visual information of the moving lips and face. To us, just look at the spatial distribution of the speech tracking. That was also an important point, is that the main source of that speech tracking was similar in the listen condition and in the video condition. And most importantly, in the left hemisphere, the delay associated to this response was not significantly different in the two conditions. So in addition to be similar in terms of topography, it is also similar in terms of timing, at least in the left hemisphere. So all this suggested that the coupling we saw in the video-only condition could be explained by a recording of the visual signal into an auditory representation. But to confirm that, we addressed four alternative hypotheses framed in terms of questions. And the first was, is this coupling in the video-only condition explained by general temporal characteristics of the auditory speech? And the answer was no, because the coupling was higher with the unheard speech than with unrelated speech sounds. The second question is of whether it is specific to seeing the speaker's face. And yes, it was, because in the control video condition, we did not find significant coherence, and the coherence was higher in the video condition than the control video condition in the auditory cortices. The third question was whether it could be due to lip reading induced visual activity being directly fed to auditory areas. So, because lip movements and the sound signal do correlate, it could be that the auditory cortical activity is actually just following lip movements more than speech sounds. But that was the other way around. So, at auditory cortices, the tracking of the auditory speech was significantly higher than the tracking of the visual signal, that is, mouth opening. On the other hand, the brain, a brain area in close to the angular gyrus was significantly coupled with lip movements at a further rate. And finally, we ask whether the auditory cortical tracking of the absent speech could be mediated by edges in the visual stimuli that would modulate auditory cortical activity. Although we found a significant coupling with a signal that tagged this global visual change, that is the frame-to-frame difference in the visual signal, we found that such a global visual change signal explained a different part of the variance than the unheard speech signal. And the last piece of result was that in the visual cortex, we found significant tracking of the lip movements, but at frequencies higher than 1 hertz. And we did not find any hint of speech recording at frequencies above 1 hertz. So there was no auditory cortical entrainment to the syllabic structure of the unheard speech in the video only condition. So to sum up, we found that there was a similar auditory cortical tracking of heard speech and unheard speech in terms of cortical origin and time course, hinting at the recording of auditory cortical information, especially because we excluded 4 alternative hypotheses that are listed here and I detailed in the results section. So we were only left with the hypothesis of an efficient synthesis mechanism that would map facial articulatory mouth gestures onto corresponding sound features. And in that respect, it is very likely that the brain leverages the natural visual to auditory delay, that is of about 90 to 170 milliseconds. So lip movements always come first, and then comes the sound. And that gives a head start to the brain to process the visual information and inform auditory cortices about that. So the main question was also whether it could be related to auditory imagery. And let's first attempt to define what is meant by auditory imagery. So it is traditionally defined as a perceptual auditory processing that is not triggered by auditory stimulation. So definitely our results are not compatible with imagery of related speech sounds, because our participants were not professional lip readers and they were not cued about the content of the speech. So there was no way the participants could tell about what they were actually being told visually. And whether it could be related to imagery of an related speech sound is also not an option, because the coupling we observed was stronger with the corresponding speech than with related speech sounds. So the most likely explanation is that Because the frequency is below 1 hertz match with the repetition rate of phrases, stress and sentential rhythmicity. And that such tracking has been hypothesized to reflect speech parsing or chunking in the context of speech listening. We could hypothesize that the brain manages to use visual information to define excitability periods to help syntactic processing of the incoming speech. As I mentioned, there was no tracking of the absent speech at 4 to 8 words and neither at 2 to 4, which shows that there was no synthesis of the syllabic structure of the sound. But it is worth pointing at a study by the group of Laylor by Michael Cross that demonstrated that such coupling could occur, but when the participants are presented with well-known silent speech. So to go back to the model of visual speech processing, here is how we see that our data could be put in parallel with that model. So when seeing lip movements, visual brain regions would extract the time course of these lip movements at higher frequencies than 1 hertz. Based on that information, a brain area that is known as the temporal visual speech area, located in the close vicinity of the angular gyrus, would extract a slower representation of the lip movements, that is, lip movements at frequencies below 1 hertz. And that information could then be transformed into a estimation of the auditory envelope or the low frequency content of the speech temporal envelope to define excitability periods for the auditory cortices and enhance processing of the speech. As a take home, I have presented two studies today, one showing that the cortical tracking of speech is an interesting tool to probe speech processing, and also to probe, in the second study, visual speech. On a more general note, I would like to stress that the framework I have presented, that is investigating the different dimensions of speech, is very promising to better understand how the brain deals with all these dimensions. And it would be very important for further studies not to limit to easy experimental settings where we just present speech and study speech processing, but go beyond and see how the brain integrates all the multiple dimensions of speech, including the body gestures associated to that speech. And of course, I would like to finish that talk by thanking all my collaborators and also you for your attention. Thank you.